Hi, this is Gordon Schoenfeld, here today with three lawyers from O'Melveny & Myers for a roundtable discussion on legal issues related to autonomous vehicles. The lawyers are Melody Drummond Hansen, a litigation partner and chair of O'Melveny's Automated and Connected Vehicles Group, Heather Meeker, a corporate partner and a member of the Automated and Connected Vehicles Group, and Jason Orr, litigation counsel and also a member of the Automated and Connected Vehicles Group. What sort of software framework is used for autonomous vehicles? And what sort of legal issues could arise from use of the software? I guess we're talking about IP, patents, liability issues, and tort claims. So please tell me what you think.
Thank you, Gordy. This is Melody Drummond Hansen. You know, two of the key areas that are relevant to autonomous vehicles in the software space are open source and machine learning. And there are a number of particular IP and other issues that arise in these two developing areas. And we have here with us Heather Meeker, who is an open source expert. And so I wanted to get some of Heather's thoughts about the role that open source plays in the AV space and the types of questions that it raises.
Thanks, Melody. Well, first of all, open source software is everywhere today. I'm not sure most people are aware of that, but it substantially runs the entire web. So it's ubiquitous. You're using it every moment. And that situation has developed over a number of years. However, in autonomous vehicles, it is also going to be absolutely ubiquitous. One of the reasons for that is that people have concerns that the software that does things like run how your car interacts with the environment should be auditable, and it should be transparent. And there should be, you know, some accountability for how it's made. And that's one thing that open source is very good at. Open source has been in vehicles for many years, but mostly has been limited to the entertainment console. Now it's moving into the vehicle control, drivetrain, etc. The thing that's important to understand about open source is that it's sort of a gift that software developers give to the world. And therefore, it's often not a commercial product. Because it's not, automobile manufacturers will have a very complicated supply chain when they're using lots of open source software. If something goes wrong with the software that runs the vehicle, there might not be just one person that they can identify as responsible, or even one piece of software that's responsible, because creating the AV software involves putting together a great many open source components.
And Heather, what kinds of contractual questions, and including around warranties, come up in the open source space?
Well, open source software, as I said, it's a gift, and so it's usually provided with no warranties. There are some open source vendors who provide manufacturers with warranties on software, but a lot of it is really just, it's out there to use at one's own risk. So the open source licenses that people use to give the software away, they disclaim warranties, meaning they say, this is as is, you use it at your own risk, I'm not responsible for whatever you do with it. And that means that there might be attempts if for instance, there's a problem, and there's somebody gets hurt or property gets hurt, to find a person to be responsible. And those disclaimers of warranties, which have been around for many years, might get tested in the autonomous vehicle context.
Heather, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I had a question here. This raises questions about litigation. Until now, has there been much litigation with regard to open software, even in a non-vehicle context?
There has not been a lot for liability, tort liability of the sort that you're thinking about. Mm-hmm. There's been some litigation over how the licenses work and how IP interacts with the licenses, but no, we're expecting that this will potentially involve litigation that we haven't seen before.
And considering the nature of open software, you know, the fact that it's open and not claimed by anyone in particular, why would you expect more litigation due to autonomous vehicles than before now?
I think that's two reasons. One, the autonomous vehicles are making heavy use of open source software. Mm-hmm. And two, you know, vehicles are potentially high liability products because they can result in accidents and damage. And so this is going to be the perfect storm, I think, where there's enough potential liability so that people really have an incentive to test the boundaries of those licenses in ways they have not before.
Okay.
And Gordy,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Gordy, this is Melody. To add to what Heather was saying, you know, mm-hmm. we at O'Melveny have litigated some of the few cases that have dealt with the issue about the contractual obligations in certain open source licenses. Mm-hmm. One of the cases that Heather and I litigated together is a case called Parents. And it dealt with some essential questions about the types of, and this is for Bruce Parents, the types of obligations there are when you take on, when you promote open source, including open source for security type features. And it dealt with the types of IP risks if you breach open source obligations. And so to echo Heather's point, this is a perfect storm scenario because AVs are already going to be a really active IP space. We're already seeing early cases in the trade secret space. It's not long before we'll see copyright and patents added to that. And open source software adds some layers to that that I think Heather could speak to, including the ways that it impacts patent rights, potential for copyright claims and the like.
Yes, Heather, please, if you would, expand on that.
Yes, open source licenses, while they have been around for a long time, they're sort of a new animal in intellectual property. And the quintessential open source licenses are literally kind of a pun on copyright law. They're called copyleft licenses. And those, while people in practice, like me and other technology transactions lawyers who deal with this day to day, are now pretty comfortable with the ideas they represent, there is very little law on them. And so every time you have a question about open source licensing, it tends to be a new area of law, mm-hmm. difficult to sort out and expensive to litigate. And they are essentially copyright licenses, but they interact with trademark issues, with, of course, copyright issues and patent issues as well. And there are many unsettled questions about how those things all interact.
How are you advising clients to protect themselves with regard to open source software?
Well, the first thing we always do with clients is make sure that they're complying with the licenses. And most companies understand now that they have to do that. There is some sort of overhead in terms of internal process to comply with the terms of the licenses. But we also help them understand what risks they're taking on, both on the IP part of it and also on the liability part of it. So that's really a question of internal decision-making and risk appetite for the clients. But I will say that it seems likely that almost all autonomous vehicles are going to be based on open source software to some degree or another, many heavily so. And that is pretty much a business necessity. So it's almost more a question of understanding the risks than completely avoiding them.
What are the current rules of the road for AV? Any specific legislation that you can point to that is considered specific to the area? How are regulations perhaps different on the state and federal levels? And which states or even countries are leading the way in terms of AV regulation?
Yeah, first, Gordy, this is Melody. I'll set the stage by saying developing regulations is something that we at O'Melveny follow very closely. We have a kind of widget on our website that tracks state by state certain key areas that we're watching in regulation. We also, you know, talk about federal developments, slow as they may be. And in addition to that, there are a number of non, you know, quote unquote regulatory areas where there are important developments happening, including in standards bodies. And we've been involved in helping our clients determine where relevant regulations are being developed that are relevant to their businesses, and where it's possible, how they can get involved in sharing information with regulators to help them develop the regulations. And Jason Orr, who's on the line, is a real expert on the developing state and federal regulations. And so I'd offer that he has some observations that would be helpful here.
Great.
Yeah, well, Gordy, as you mentioned, the regulations can be different at the federal and the state level. And as Melody was alluding to, it's quite a project to try to keep track of the shifting landscape for our clients. At the federal level right now, there is no legislation that is specifically governing automated vehicles. A couple of years ago, there were bills in Congress that failed to pass both houses. And although there's sometimes talking of rebooting that legislative effort, right now we have no legislation. Eventually, I think we will see it, but given the state of play and legislative priorities, I wouldn't expect it immediately. In addition to legislation, there's no federal regulation either in the form of binding rules from executive agencies. Right now, the federal government's position is that they're conscious of interfering with or inhibiting the development of these technologies. And they've chosen a light touch that allows this industry to develop and relies on standard setting at the industry level. And that's where a lot of the action is right now, as Melody was mentioning earlier. Standards making bodies made up of professionals in the industry who are steeped in the relevant issues and are kind of working together to develop best practices. In terms of the federal agencies themselves, they're in the process of developing rules, but it is a slow process. And so right now there are no binding rules, and it's still kind of in the early stages of developing rules. That said, I can say that the Department of Transportation is using authorities that it has apart from rulemaking. They've been granting some exemptions from motor vehicle safety standards where appropriate. They have this ability to make exceptions where they conclude that, you know, the vehicles that they're making exceptions for are not going to pose a threat to public safety. So for instance, under current rules, every motor vehicle that operates on public roads needs to have a steering wheel, brake pedals, and other human-centric features. But recently, one of the federal agencies in charge of regulating motor vehicles granted an exemption to allow a company to operate low-speed autonomous delivery vehicles on roads that don't even have passenger cabins at all. They just have compartments into which deliveries can be placed in, and they kind of ride along public streets autonomously. That's an example of how the government's using its authorities to encourage innovation without prematurely making rules that could result in unexpected negative consequences for the industry or for the public.
Mm-hmm. And one of the ways, this is Melody, that we're helping clients in the regulatory space is by advising them when they should chime in on advance notices of proposed rulemaking. So this is one of the other activities that's going on in the lack of a kind of sweeping federal legislation. The agencies still are attempting to move forward with proposing rules that would apply more broadly to autonomous vehicles, that would provide some guidance. And so a number of our clients, you know, come to us to better understand which of those proposed rulemakings should they be responding to and what the content of those responses should be. So that's another way that in the absence of federal regulations, the industry really can still take advantage of this opportunity to be involved and to share information with regulators and to develop relationships with regulators so that they can, you know, have the information that they need.
How are you advising clients with regard to regulation in the AV space? You know, it seems like there's a lot that's just not developed, as we were discussing with litigation, for example. What can companies do, I guess, to protect themselves? And I guess, to what can they do perhaps to achieve some type of competitive advantage with regard to regulation?
Sure. There are a couple of ways that we advise companies in the regulatory space. One is in their direct interactions with regulatory agencies. So whether it's dealing with the California DMV or the California Public Utilities Commission, or dealing with National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration, you know, we advise clients in responding to requests from those agencies. We advise clients in how to get testing permits or deployment permits, and Jason has been really instrumental in that type of work. We also are trying to help clients predict the future, in a sense, you know, identify what the trends are. I think this is particularly relevant in cybersecurity and privacy, but also help digest the kinds of themes that we see coming out of guidance from the Department of Transportation or from international bodies, to say, where do we think this will go? And, and you know, we tailor that to particular industries. We represent clients from aftermarket kit makers to folks that are making, you know, entire autonomous vehicles or fleets of vehicles. We advise components manufacturers. There are a lot of relevant components manufacturers, from, you know, data storage to semiconductors, that you might not think of as having an interest in this space, but they really do. And so we help them see how their particular business fits in with these regulations. And again, if there are opportunities for them to get involved and develop relationships with regulators and educate them on how their technology works, we help them do that, such as through the advance notice of proposed rulemaking process.
Just touching on that for a moment, it seems that in general, particularly because this is such an undeveloped legal space, that companies should perhaps be very proactive in getting in front of regulators and getting to know them and getting to anticipate their questions and presumably also to educate them. Is that fair and accurate to say?
That's fair, and that is definitely something that many companies are doing, is trying to develop great relationships with governments at every level. Mm-hmm. So I would say that that's definitely something that's important to a lot of our clients and a lot of people in this space.
Yeah, I think that's right, and there. It's important because this technology is difficult to understand. And as someone who, I'm an IP lawyer, I try a lot of patent cases, and you have to describe difficult technology to people who are unfamiliar with it often. And so this is an important part of what companies can do with regulators too, help them understand more about how the technology works and why that would lead to certain types of considerations for regulations. And it also is about trust. You know, we're in a time when there is a lot of mistrust of big companies, including tech companies. And so it's important to develop those relationships sort of before you need them. with regulators so that they know that they can trust you, that you are giving them accurate information that's helpful.
Well, the broad question is, what are the most important legal issues to keep in mind with regard to data security and privacy? And let's keep these issues very specific to AVs, because that's, I think, what the readers will most want to know about.
Right. So data security, and really what you might want to call it is cybersecurity, is a key part of ensuring confidence and safety for automated vehicles. So there's a real worry that a hacker could take over a car or a truck, or even worse, a fleet of cars or trucks. And there are some known vulnerabilities, and there's also a recognition that no matter how cyber secure you make a vehicle, that there are always people who are going to try to find a way in. And so there's a lot of emphasis on not making a perfectly secure vehicle, but instead developing resilience and responsiveness to cybersecurity in the space. And there's a lot of work around developing standards for cybersecurity specific to the concerns of AVs. You know, Jason mentioned the telecommunications part, and that's often a place where some vulnerabilities can arise. And so there's a lot of work being done to really look at the specific technical functionality of AVs and address those concerns. Another thing that's important to understand here is that there's some competing interests about data sharing that are in play that make these questions more difficult. And, you know, there's a baseline question that sharing data may make vehicles safer and may lead to quicker development, but sharing too much data may impact intellectual property rights or may actually lead to a hacker knowing too much about how a system works. And there's been a recent development that I wonder if Jason wants to speak to in terms of the federal government encouraging AV developers to share data.
I believe it was yesterday that NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, announced a data sharing platform that it's developed in conjunction with several partners that would allow AV developers to share certain types of information with regulators, both at the state and federal level, and with the public. So it would be a website that anyone could go to and just find out where automated vehicle testing is taking place and kind of what vehicles are being tested or even at what times, to kind of provide more transparency for the industry and to provide some confidence to the public about the measures that are being taken in the industry to conduct, you know, consistent, reliable testing.
And I would add that all of this data being collected, communicated, and available raises a lot of privacy concerns that are specific to AVs. So we all know that companies around the world and particularly companies touching California have learned that they have a lot of privacy issues to attempt to get their heads around whatever their industry is. But there are some particular privacy issues for autonomous vehicles. So as an example, autonomous vehicles collect data that may often implicate privacy concerns, such as location data, the trips that the individuals go on, there are often internal facing cameras that may capture, you know, human faces. There are external facing cameras that may capture the world around a vehicle. And these all raise, you know, important privacy considerations that AV companies have to address. Yeah, I think part of it is the consumer expectations piece. And Jason, did you want to speak to the types of steps you can take in managing consumer expectations around these areas?
Sure. One of the things that a lot of companies have now is a privacy policy. And some of the privacy legislation actually requires certain companies to have a privacy policy. And as mentioned earlier, Melody mentioned that the FTC is one of the key enforcers of privacy at the federal level in the United States. And they've actually gone after some companies not for having insufficient privacy, but for not failing to live up to what they represented to their customers was going to be their privacy policy. So one thing that we would advise companies to do is to be true to the privacy policy that you put in place. Mm-hmm. And it's important for that privacy policy to be clear and understandable to consumers, and that it be accurate in terms of what the company is doing.